The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Living Well into the Future with your host, Julie B. Adler. We invite you to join us in our continuing investigation of resilience as we speak with solution makers who engage with issues vital to our future: food, housing, climate, and health. From the beginning of our series, we sought to engage all generations in discussion of those issues that affect us all. In this episode, we speak with three college students who literally are our future. Members of Gen Z, their lives have been affected by COVID, school shootings, and climate change, among other things. How they view and plan for the future is the subject of this episode. Write to us to let us know if this or any of our other episodes have given rise to discussions or actions on your part. Let us know which episodes were relevant to your life, what you want to hear more about. You can reach us through our website, livingwellintothefuture.net, where you can get more information about our guests, show notes, and information about past episodes. Or you can write to us at LWITF22@gmail.com.
I'm your host, Julie B. Adler. A central goal of this podcast is to spark cross-generational conversation and discussion so we may better move together toward a healthy future. Throughout the series, we have spoken with people ranging in age from their teens into their 80s, esteemed scientists, award-winning architects, and innovators and solution makers have all participated with us to stimulate all to work together to enable a future in which all live well. In this episode, we'll speak with three college students, members of Gen Z. While we recognize people as unique individuals, we tend to make broad generalizations about groups. For members of Gen Z, born between 1996 and 2010, there are books and statistics galore. For me, and perhaps for you, generations can be better understood through the words of the people who experience it. Not because a few people can represent many, but because their uniqueness can provide a gateway to our further discussions and understanding. Two of our guests study at McAllister College in Minnesota and one at Southern Methodist University in Texas. During their time over the past two decades growing up in Massachusetts, Oklahoma, and Texas, respectively, they shared experiences common to many American students of their generation. The conversations you will hear are the first conversations that I had with each of them, removing the baggage of being a relative or close friend of the family would lead to a more free and open conversation, I thought. First, let's meet Sydney Janda, a second-year student at McAllister College in Minnesota. Sydney says that her generation is fatalistic. Let's find out what that means. Fatalistic, meaning that you're not going to impact the world around you?
Yeah, not the world's not going to be around for much longer, too.
Wow.
Yeah, it's going to be climate change is going to get us, or nuclear war or something like that. It's just a general feeling that people really struggle sometimes, I think, to see. We all talk about our futures and people have hopes and dreams still, but I also think there's an underlying sense of, I don't know if we're even going to exist in 10 years.
You have chosen to study international studies. Do your classes present this kind of angst and fatalism as you describe it?
But my international studies major, I have a human rights concentration within that. And I don't know what that's going to look like yet. I would work for an NGO, maybe work for the government, law school might be an option and become an attorney in international affairs. There's just so much suffering in the world. And I don't think it's fair to just give up. I don't think that's fair for anyone. And so I really want to dedicate my life to helping people, even when it seems like they can't be helped, whenever a situation seems like too terrible or too far gone. So that's what I want to do with that. In terms of my classes and how they intersect with the world around us. So I take the depressing classes because of my human rights concentration. I'm not taking classes about how mankind has done the right thing. I took an intro to international studies course, which really was looking at the world order. And then through that class, we had a lot of discussions on globalization, which I think underscores all of international studies in the sense. Yeah. And I think it brings to mind two things for me. One, that's how COVID spread so fast. It's because we're so globalized and interconnected. And two, and that's part of the reason why social media is so dangerous, is because it's part of a globalized system. It's just everyone's so interconnected. And it's really easy to just get so much information or misinformation in your face all the time. I've also taken several history classes, which I think speak to the history of countries struggling to be accountable, but also the history of real human suffering and atrocity. And that's part of why I just don't think it's fair for us to just give up, because there are people who have been through so much worse. And they still believed. And at the end of the day, I think we're all fortunate in a lot of ways. I think the mental health impact is something that really needs to be addressed. But especially here at McAllister, right, we're going to a good school. We have food to eat. We have a place to sleep. So that kind of that work and those classes really put it in perspective for me that people who went through slavery or survived the Holocaust still believed in that the world was worth something. I don't see why we can't do the same. And then in terms of how like my professors and our classes interact with us on that level, I definitely think that they know that people aren't very happy with the world. Mac's a very activist school and people are pretty open about their feelings. So yeah, they definitely know. I also think that our professors themselves are very satisfied with the world too. So that kind of comes out. But I wouldn't say that anyone really is aware of like how truly fatalistic people my age are. I don't think I was ever fully aware of it until I've just continually had conversations and realized, oh, I think it's more about what can we do to address things and make a change. But I don't think anywhere really that there's a conversation on what do you do with the fact that there are so many young people that legitimately believe that in 10 years, we're not going to be here. There's not been any effort to really talk about that, because I think a lot of people my age have just accepted that or are okay with that or are making themselves be okay with that. And not really working to try and achieve balance and to see the light at the end of the tunnel, because I think it goes back to the mental health impacts of COVID and social media and all of it.
We'll get to the COVID and its effect on you and our other guests in just a minute. But how do you live life during college when the dread is so great?
That's a good question. I think still people are complicated. I think there still can be that mindset, but people will still work to enjoy their time in college. And what I also don't know sometimes is if people just say that because that's how they're coping with the state of the world, but they don't actually believe that, right? If they're just being angsty just because they feel that way too. I think that's part of it. But a lot of it is it's just, that's a later problem. We're going to enjoy the present. But it's not like there's a bunch of people walking around that are just really like depressed actively. I think depression now manifests itself where it's much more hidden and it comes out in certain ways. But yeah, I think it's much more so just, I can't tell sometimes if it's a belief, if it's a fear, if it's both, if it's some strange coping mechanism, because it doesn't matter, we're not going to be here in 10 years. But I think it can be all those things for different people. I don't know.
Having heard Sydney's analysis, let's go back and look at what has led to the state of affairs she describes. Again, turning to Sydney, where did you grow up?
So I was born in a town called Lawton, Oklahoma. Most of my time growing up was there. We moved when I was 13. to Norman, which is where University of Oklahoma is, for context. So I went to high school there.
How did your education proceed once COVID hit?
What my school did is they just said that we're going to be out for 2 weeks. And that's just all they said. I think that's what a lot of schools said. But it was getting pretty clear that was not going to be what happened. So essentially, people freaked out a little because we didn't have the infrastructure in our schools to handle a lot of online and remote work. And so it was a little tricky. I had teachers that just had us do a few assignments and then called it a day. And I probably was done with school by April. Like, all my work was done because we just didn't know what to do.
If it's a college community, probably internet connectivity wasn't a problem. People had internet and had computers.
Not everyone did in the district. I think I remember correctly, like over 60% of students qualify for free and reduced lunch. So that was a problem too. People just didn't have Wi-Fi or computers. And the other problem was, is the school just didn't really have the infrastructure built in yet. No one really knew what to do. So my sophomore year, we started off, the district bought Canvas for us to use, which you can turn in assignments easily. It's a list of stuff to do. It's way better. So we would have that. And the first 2 weeks were completely remote. And then we had the option to go back to school on A and B days if we wanted to. So we would only go to school like a couple days a week. And I tried doing that once and I thought, nope, because it freaked me out. Because there were still a lot of people. It was rough. And I thought, I don't want to do this. So my parents and I don't have any brothers or sisters. So we were a pod. And then my grandmother was also part of our pod because she lived alone, but she was severely immunocompromised. She had a liver transplant in the 90s. Oh, and that was also part of it too. I thought, I don't want to do anything and it just wasn't much of an education at that point. Like, being there, it wasn't really adding to my experience. What little experience there was at that point. So the fall of my sophomore year, I was completely remote. In the spring, I went to school in the morning and then my mom would pick me up and we would go home and I would go there and I would eat because we did not want to be, you know, eating at the school. And then she'd take me back to my afternoon classes. And that was how I got through the spring of my sophomore year. By my junior year in the fall, things had pretty much returned to normal at that point.
Thank you, Sydney. We'll return to Sydney Janda in a few minutes. Right now, let's speak with Matthew Allaire, who is also in his second year at McAllister College in Minnesota. Could you tell me something about your background?
I grew up in Newton, Massachusetts, which is a suburb of Boston. My father is a software engineer, and so I grew up around a lot of personal electronics, probably more so than most people my age, and that was good for me, right? My first year of high school was interrupted by COVID. It was the middle of the spring. I remember going home from, I think, what was like a canceled class that I had. I was like in the cafeteria playing some games on my computer with some friends, going home and then just getting an email saying, okay, we're not coming back for 2 weeks, right? And so it's okay, it's 2 weeks, right? That seems like nothing. 2 weeks becomes 1 month, and then 1 month becomes like we're suspending school for the rest of the year. And we did online class. The next year started up in the fall with courses still being held remotely. Students were invited to come back into the building in the spring, but many chose not to. So I would say I was definitely impacted by COVID.
Let's talk about both how that affected you educationally and also how you feel it affected you socially.
Yeah, so I was considered by my parents and my teachers throughout most of my childhood a pretty good student. Right. I always felt like it was my job to be a student first and to have friends and go do things that kids should be doing second. So throughout elementary, middle school, and beginning of high school, I was doing very well in school. And what happened, a big hobby of mine has always been video games and online gaming. And as soon as the COVID pandemic hit, my parents felt like they could no longer reasonably enforce any sort of rules or guidelines around technology use because I was cut off from all of my other different forms of social interaction. So it was just, okay, you're in your room, you're on your computer, you could be doing school, you could be doing something else. It's not in our interest even to police you on this because we're all trying to get by right now. So this meant that the sort of possibility space of distractions that I could be experiencing when I was in virtual class was just widened. Before it was like, okay, you got all your friends around you who are maybe paying attention, maybe not. You can look at your phone if your phone vibrates, or you can look at the window or start spinning your pencil on your finger. But there's really not much else to do. You're compelled to pay attention to the teacher. That's the model of a classroom. However, virtual learning proved quite difficult for me. I found it hard to stay motivated to do school when there were other things that I could be doing that were more enticing, some of them like quite addictive, right? Online gaming. And that was another big social emotional outlet for me. I wasn't able to see my friends in person, so I decided to see my friends and meet new people online, and because that's what I'm going to do. I'm a young adult trying to get the social validation that I need in order to remain happy and healthy. And so I found myself just not attending class, failing to submit assignments, all of the bad things you'd associate with poor academic standing. I didn't do well. I, for a period of time, thought that I was not going to graduate with good enough grades to go to college. And I was actually okay with it for a while because I thought, you know, I'm doing all this other stuff.
What kind of other stuff were you doing?
Yeah, so it's mostly, I'm pretty vague there intentionally because it's a point of shame now. Most of the other stuff was online video gaming. So I, for a period of time, considered becoming a professional video game player or content creator instead of going to school. I put a lot of time, a lot of hours into it. I would play for money. I would treat it as a career prospect in the same way that a student athlete might like treat that as a career prospect above their academics. Now, obviously, there's not quite the scaffolding in place for somebody who wants to do that than somebody who wants to like join the NFL, in part because it's so much more fraught. It's an incredibly risky thing to do with your career. Even if it does work out, you'll be 26, you'll retire with a couple million dollars, but you'll be depressed. You'll like all these negative things associated with spending too much time playing online games and not interacting with your community. I got sucked into the internet as this sort of time vacuum.
Let's leave it at that for a moment and find out how our third guest, Zoe Gerwitz, a junior at Southwest Methodist University, experienced COVID. Welcome, Zoe Gerwitz.
Thank you.
To Living Well into the Future. You're a junior now. You went to school in San Antonio, is that right?
Yeah, I'm still suffering the consequences of COVID right now. But yeah, it happened like around spring break of my sophomore year in high school. We had that extended spring break. And at first we were all like, whoa, we get extra time off. But then after that, we realized, oh, we're not going to go back to school for a while. So it was a shock at first. But definitely one of the big things was social interactions. They just went away after a while and school went back on Zoom. And I saw my friends, but only at a distance. And so really, we missed that physical interaction, just being around people all that time. And that's a really big part, I think, of just human nature, just being around other people. And so when that huge factor is taken away, I think it causes a lot of problems for everyone. So I think definitely depression and anxiety skyrocketed for a lot of people. And also I grew super addicted to social media because that was a huge way to connect with my friends and people that I'm not able to see on a daily basis. So I think that was a really huge part of that whole pandemic experience, just trying to get that connection with people through other means. So that was definitely it. And so now I'm just still trying to recover from this lack of social interaction for almost 2 years. So it's a really big dent out of my life. And yeah, I think that social interaction is a huge part of just developing. When you take that away, that's a huge component of your development that you're just eradicating.
Did you get to have graduation?
Yeah, my senior year was almost back to normal. That's when I started going back to classes. So especially for me, it was since I'm a musician and I was like always in the ensembles at school and just playing with other people, I wasn't able to do that anymore. And that was like a huge part of my life. And so that was really sad because I can't play my instrument with other people and I'm just here by myself. So it's sad.
Did you put more time into your instrument?
Funny you should ask. I kind of regret now not putting more time into my instrument because it's like, what else was I supposed to do? But I should have spent more time practicing. And with oboe, there's like a huge thing about reed making. Oboists make their own reeds. And so I feel like during that time, I should have taken advantage of that whole COVID situation and just really set to work and practiced and made reeds. But I actually didn't really do that very much. I was more along the lines of, okay, I have all this free time. I'm just going to do what I enjoy, leisure activities. I'm going to like watch movies and read books and play with my dogs and whatnot. So I probably should have spent a lot more time practicing and stuff like that. But
so how do you think it's affected your social activities now at college and the interactions between your classmates and people at school?
Yeah, I'm getting back to normal, just having normal interactions with people. But at the time when I saw like a person, I was like, oh, I don't want to get sick. So I'm just like, I'm just so used to keeping this distance from other people. It's, oh, being near people is bad. And I made that association during COVID. So wow. I'm still trying to be like, okay, it's fine now. You're allowed to be near and close to people. You'll be fine. But yeah, and I feel like just missing 1.5 years of normal social interaction, it's been like, I haven't been able to almost quote unquote practice interacting with people. There's still a lot of social anxiety going on whenever I'm in a room with a lot of people. I don't know if that stems exactly from COVID or if that's just something that I've been dealing with since a kid. I'm not quite sure, but definitely COVID has intensified that social anxiety aspect and just communicating with other people. So definitely that's had an impact on that for sure.
Like Zoe, Sydney Janda feels keenly that her COVID experience and those of her classmates at college who come from all over the United States and around the world has constrained her interactions. How did you feel getting to college after that up and down and in and out of COVID?
You know, every single person in my year, for the most part, like COVID hit when they were in their freshman year. And so we all were very much have that same experience. I realize this too, I talked to a lot of people. We don't always remember a lot about like COVID, particularly during lockdown. I remember certain things, but it's just pretty fuzzy. But I definitely will say that I think COVID has continues to have an impact on us and how we operate socially and in the way we view the world. So
could you explain those elements? How do you interact differently?
Yeah, I think a big thing is that it's just like a lot of people slow down in their progression of how they interact with other people socially. And I think a big part of that is that during COVID, a lot of people just started completely being online. And that was their main source of contact of anything. I personally never did that. My parents and I are very close. So I was just with them and we were talking. So I never had that. So I do definitely feel like there's a difference between people who were still talking to people or if they were doing a much more like self-isolating, maybe even talking to people online thing. And I still see it now where I feel like sometimes people are much more quickly to isolate themselves. There's just certain like social cues that they just don't, it's just like a slow progression. And I feel like you just see that in conversations where you're talking with someone and they just struggle to make eye contact with you, for example. And that obviously goes along with other things, but knowing a person and knowing that it's not some other issue, it's being really nervous to talk to new people and not being able to stomach it. I also think, yeah, it's just a slow way in which we interact. I also think that it has a continual mental health impact. I think that is the biggest crisis of my generation is mental health.
And how is that manifest? How do you see that among the people you're going to school with?
I think most everyone has some form of anxiety or depression. And it's also a lot of people have wanted to kill themselves. To be transparent, that's a pretty common thing right now. Not to want it right now, but have to have suicidal thoughts or actions in the past. And that's...
So you're hearing that from your classmates?
Yes, I am. And just from my experiences in high school too, I knew a lot of people who were having issues like that. I think part of it is that we're much more aware of mental health conditions than we once were, and society is much more open to talking about it. But I would say that there's a genuine dissatisfaction with the world and with the world order and just a lot of misery and sadness. I think it's culminated from, you know, social media, from being on our phones, from the world's just in your face 24/7. But I think COVID also plays a role in that and definitely exacerbated some of those things.
If you're having a discussion late at night, is that general feeling of, is it a hopelessness or what is it?
I would say it's a general feeling of hopelessness. You know, I think it's much less now to a certain extent, but it's still there. And I think a lot of people my age are a little bit fatalistic, which is like a terrible thing to say because our lives have barely even started. But yeah, and part of it is it's climate change, it's COVID, it's feeling like that the systems in place are just not here to protect us. And so I definitely do see that. I personally have worked really hard to not go down that path and not just decide the world's just against me. But part of that is because I've had really good support systems in place for that. And also just that's something that's been important to me. But for a lot of people who haven't had those same things, it's definitely a general sense of pretty fatalistic.
Matthew Allaire grew up almost 2,000 miles away from Sydney, but the isolation during COVID also had a profound effect on his social interactions and perceptions. Let's go back to where we left off with him.
I got sucked into the internet as this sort of time vacuum.
Obviously, you came out of it because you're at a very good college right now. So how did you do that?
Yeah, and this actually answers the second question you had, which is how COVID impacted me socially. So that is a loaded question. And it's for every member of my generation, there's just so much to say and so much that we're still working through in terms of what effect the pandemic had on us, mostly related to mental health, I think, and social emotional development. But I think the way I came out of it, there were a number of things that I witnessed in the online gaming community, I'll call it, which is dominated by a lot of young men who, for whatever reason, feel as though they have not been dealt a particularly good hand in life and are often driven to become very resentful, self-hating individuals. And most of the time, this remains self-contained or contained within communities. But anybody who's been reading the news over the past decade will know that sometimes it boils over into acts of violence. And I got a up close and personal look at how the sausage was made when it came to isolated young men becoming just this, God, angry cohort of society. And I saw that and I said, I do not want anything to do with that. That is terrifying. And if I stay here too long, that might be me.
The word you use, self-hating. Why self-hating?
I think I'll just start by stepping back and saying that I think a lot of members of my generation have problems with anxiety and depression. And seeing that as somewhat par for the course, a lot of the people I saw choosing to spend time away from their families, away from their partners, away from all of their kind of prospects at a positive life, at flourishing. Right? These are often young, like school-age men, right? Who just choose, okay, I'm not going to go to school, or I'm going to go to school just enough to pass, and I'm not going to engage with any extracurricular outlets. I'm not going to talk to my family. I really do think for a lot of people, it gets to the point where it's hard to justify your own worth as a contributor of value to society if you're spending so much time just playing video games and talking to each other online. People know they're smart, right? They get, there's this sort of meta irony that takes hold where it's, oh, I'm not useful. I'm just an outcast. They understand either because they want to be cast that way or because they genuinely have been given the short end of the stick. But it's universally acknowledged in a lot of circles of young men online that society wants nothing to do with them and they want nothing to do with society.
Did you have classmates at Newton North who were part of your circle, or was the circle of people throughout the country?
I'm glad you asked. Most of the people I was connecting with socially over the pandemic era were virtually. These are people who I had not met in person, usually of in the age range of maybe 16 to 23, and usually young men. There were people from the United Kingdom, people from across the country, people from, there's a man from Bangladesh I would talk to. There were a few members of my sort of physical community I would still talk to and who would occasionally find themselves in the same spheres, but it was mostly people who would otherwise be complete strangers.
And so wherever it was in the world, you got the same kind of feedback that they were isolated from their families and the larger society.
I think there's a self-selection thing happening here. If you have a pretty happy life in the real world, there's no reason for you to seek most of your social emotional validation from strangers on the internet. And so, yeah, definitely the Americans and the people in the United Kingdom that I would speak to had chosen or just become resigned to the fact that they were not. I didn't mean to suggest that gaming was a cause of anxiety. I think there's very little like empirical evidence to support that. I think a lot of these people have garnered their depression and anxiety and mental health struggles elsewhere and are using online gaming as a social outlet.
COVID has had a big part in affecting their education and interactions. Another set of circumstances that Gen Z students grew up with are active shooter drills and incidents involving actual shooters. We'll hear what Sydney Janda has to say about it.
When I was in kindergarten, we were playing outside, and all of a sudden, I saw like from across the street, and a guy was like getting actively arrested and tackled by police. It was this whole thing. And I was like, oh. And then my teacher called us all in. She's get inside right now. And we all lined up against the bookshelves hiding. I think my teacher did a good job of just saying, oh, we're just practicing.
So that's an early childhood memory. You saw it.
I did. My first real experience with an active shooter drill or event was Sandy Hook. I was 7 when that happened. I was in 2nd grade. And I remember my teachers were all wearing like green shirts in remembrance of what had happened. And of course, we didn't know. And then so I go home and I ask my parents. And then I remember like they looked at each other and thought, oh, how do we explain this to a 7-year-old? And they sit me down and they were honest with me. They said a man went into a school and he decided to kill a lot of people. And I was like, oh. And then I started asking like, okay, why did he do it? And they just said he was very sick. I remember asking, okay, what did he use to kill them? And they, you know, it's really dark. And eventually my parents just said, I think that's all you need to know right now. And then I said, okay. And I remember I finally asked, okay, why do I keep seeing a bunch of people my age on the news? And they said, because he hurt them. I was like, oh. So that was like my first, yeah. And then from then on, it's just a norm. You talk about it, you have a drill, teacher tells you what to do, you hide behind their desk in elementary school, I remember that, and teacher tells you that sometimes more graphic than they need to be, but saying like they would take the first bullet, and I was like, oh, okay. I had consistent lockdown drills. I think this my scariest one I had was actually when I was in 4th grade. Someone was like arrested nearby, or someone was like running around like from the police. So that's why we did that. But we don't get a ton of information. So I remember I was in 4th grade. It was at the end of the year. We were pretending we were doing a drawing exercise where we've been learning about Michelangelo. So we actually were laying on the floor and had a piece of paper taped up to the bottom of our desks and we're drawing. And then we get the, you need to lockdown. And I remember it was really horrible. And it was horrible because our teacher didn't know what was going on. And she's, of course, keeping it together. But we heard a police radio was outside of our door to our classroom. There was an outside door. And we didn't know what it was. We just heard a muffled voice. And that really freaked us all out. People in my class started sobbing, like little kids, and started praying, like, God, please, I don't want to die. Because I think for us, the way that we had, because to me, like, that muffled voice, it sounded like a monster, like a, and that's how I had envisioned, like, the Sandy Hook shooter. And so that's what I literally thought was outside our door. And I was 9, and I thought, I don't know if I'm going to make it through this. And it was all fine. It was just a police radio. We're not given enough information. We don't know what's happening. So yeah. And so I've never experienced any actual like school shooting, which I'm thankful for. I've grown up with constant news of it happening. In high school, we had drills frequently. And yeah, and teachers just saying, take a chair, take whatever you need to defend yourself.
How does this translate now in terms of how you feel around campus and just in general?
I think it feels like an accomplishment when you make it out of high school for several reasons, but because you survive, literally. And I know that sounds really dark, but I remember feeling that kind of sigh of relief. And I know my parents felt that too. You know, now I don't really worry about it a ton. First of all, like Minnesota has pretty strict gun laws. And we're a small liberal arts school. We're pretty safe in a lot of ways. Yeah, I think there is just something about a room full of 25 kids that I don't know why that would ever draw the attention of someone. But I guess if you're really sick, it does. And that feeling like you're trapped and helpless, I don't think you have that as much in college. And yeah, but I would definitely say like that is totally messed with all of us in different ways. I don't think enough studies have been done on it, but I will say that it has definitely altered our brain chemistry in terms of how we view and perceive things. Because it is traumatic. Like it is. And I don't fully realize it when you're having these lockdown drills and then they're over and then you just go on and there's no discussion about it. After that whole thing when I was in fourth grade and we heard the muffled voice by the door and all of a sudden the teacher's, oh, it's over. And that's it. There's nothing more. And it's on discussion of how we all thought we might die. It's just, oh. And so I think that being jerked back and forth like that is, it's a problem. And then the fact that we have to do it in the first place. So I definitely will say it has made us more fatalistic in certain ways.
Zoe Gerwitz, who went to high school in San Antonio, Texas, is a junior now, 1 year ahead of Matthew and Sydney. Zoe, throughout not only high school, but also grade school, you've had to deal with the lockdowns and the active shooter issues. Can you tell me how that happened and how it might have affected you?
Yeah, we've always had those drills where it's a hard lockdown in case there's someone on campus who's like a threat to us. That's just like safety precautions we've always done. And it didn't really mean anything to me as a kid. I was like, okay, we're skipping class for a second and we're like doing this mandatory drill. That's fine. But then we'd have like actual scenarios where there's like a dangerous person on campus and we actually have to like, okay, this is serious, guys, be quiet because there's like an active threat on campus. So we've definitely had to deal with that for a while. We've had bomb threats. I remember in elementary school, we got some kind of anonymous email sent to a bunch of schools in the district. And so we had to have class in different areas that were, I don't want to say bomb threat safe, but we definitely went in classrooms that were away from windows and stuff. And we just watched movies that day. So it definitely has taken away from education somewhat. But, you know, these threats exist and we've definitely had to compensate to take the right safety precautions for that. So, yeah.
How does that make you feel in an educational setting at this point?
I don't feel great about it. And now that I'm on like a college campus, we have, since it's a private school, we have laws against open carry. So you can't just walk on campus with a gun, even if you have a permit, like it's not allowed. But I still don't feel super safe, especially since there's like a large increase in gun violence, especially on college campuses. I do walk around with that fear inside of me as I'm just walking to class. I'm like, wow, what if someone just starts shooting up the campus? What are we going to do about that? Because it happens sometimes and there's not really much you can do about it, but it is scary.
In Massachusetts, Matthew Allaire also experienced the active shooter drills, but his experience was a little different from Sydney's and Zoe.
When you were in high school and even in grade school, did you have to respond to active shooter drills, active shooter situations?
I think the first grade was when I first remember doing one. We only ever had to lock down the school once because a wild turkey had entered the building. But we were still, everyone was still quite aware that was a threat in American schools. So I think a lot of people, even when we were as young as 8, 9, 10 in our generation, understood that to be reality, yes.
And do you feel that it has affected your attitude toward getting together with people or being even at college?
Like on the day-to-day, do I associate a higher amount of risk with going to a social gathering knowing that there could be an active shooter?
Yes.
Personally, I don't think so. I know that there are people in my life who grew up around more guns than I did who have that fear.
We started this episode with a discussion of traumatic events. Sydney describes a fatalism that she sees in her classmates. But despite this, she, and as you will hear, Matthew and Zoe, also have a firm vision for the future and their contributions to it. Sydney, do you have time for activism in terms of the election?
Not really. Open dialogue doesn't really exist on issues like that right now. It's honestly a lot of cancel culture, to be honest with you on that. Like if you say the wrong thing or you ask the wrong question, you're seen as someone who was a bigot or a horrible person. And yeah, there really isn't a lot of dialogue.
You are also hardworking and very engaged in your studies. Are you not?
Yes, I am.
We've talked about the very difficult and disturbing and dangerous things that are going on. What makes you get up and work hard and do all the things that you're doing?
I think it's hope for the future. Like I said before, I understand the tendency to want to give up and feel like the whole world is against you. But I've never thought that was fair to ourselves or to anyone else. So what gets me up is it's wanting to get an education to learn and to one day be able to go out and help people and to make the world better. I really strongly feel that way. And I think that's the most important thing that we can do as human beings is to help each other. I think I said this earlier, it's just not fair for us when we're going to a nice school to just decide that the world's falling apart because there are so many people who are suffering and are losing their homes and their families in horrific ways that we can only fathom. And it's not fair to just give up on them or on the world. So that's what keeps me going in the belief that the powers that be, that it will work out okay, because the U.S. has been in far more precarious situations. Yeah. Hopefully that stays the same, but I don't know.
Let's go back to Zoe Gerwitz in Texas. I asked her if she too felt that there was a general feeling of hopelessness among her classmates and how that affects her feeling about the future.
Do you discuss these issues with your friends and how it might affect you going forward?
Yeah, almost like with my friends, we're almost like in a position where we're like, oh yeah, it's inevitable. There's not much we can do about it. We're almost in like this hopeless state where like, okay, climate change is going to get worse. All these problems are going to get worse. There's really not much we can do about it. So we're in that mindset, which is honestly so disheartening and upsetting that we're not hopeful for the future. We're okay, this is how it is. Nothing's going to happen about it. But I know we should probably take a more proactive stance on this and actually try to make a difference. But that's just how a lot of us feel. I'm trying to be more optimistic about all of these issues, but it's as it is. Things are getting worse. There's not a lot of action taken by world leaders to fix these problems. It's just, it is getting very much worse. And we just have a very hopeless mindset, which is very sad, but that's just how we feel.
You have a double major of oboe and psychology.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you choose that double major? What are you thinking about and why do you want to study it?
Yeah, I love music. It's always been a part of me and I just don't want to let that go. As of now, my track is to just become a professional orchestral musician. So if I can land a job in a major symphony, that would be great. That's my dream right now. So we'll see how that goes. My mom is a flute player. She's also a teacher. My brother's a French horn player and he's also a teacher. So I've always been around music since I can remember. And so music is just a way for me to step back from all of these issues going on in life and just be happy, play music. I love performing for other people because I could see that it makes them happy. It makes them feel something else and it takes them away from reality. And I just love being able to do that. And I think music has so much power and it especially has power with these world problems too. Like I know there is some music that is made and performed to bring attention to these issues. Like there is this composer called John Luther Adams, and he made all of these pieces to bring attention to climate change, which I thought was so interesting. I think one of them is called Becoming Ocean. It's a really great piece and it's bringing attention to these problems. So I think that's a really great thing to do. And so I think music is a great way to bring attention to these issues and also to step away from these issues and just be happy.
As you will hear, Matthew has learned from his experience with the addictive world of online gaming to form a future in which he can help make changes for the good.
There's a high level of tolerance for misogyny, racism, all of the sort of casual forms of bigotry you can imagine being thrown around in like a very demographically homogenous community. That's what the culture of online gaming is. Not because of the games, but because of who plays them. And I think there was a point where I realized that the sort of logical conclusion of me spending my life here was that I was going to end up a very unhappy, spiteful person.
Did your parents stage an intervention at some point?
They thought about it. I've talked with them after the fact. They definitely thought about it. They knew that I was spending a lot of time on online games and I was talking to people, and my father understood the technology I was using a lot better than most people because he's a software engineer. And so he was much more comfortable letting me do that. Not because he was okay with what I was like, the types of people I was talking to. He just didn't know. Every kid is going to keep secrets from their parents. This is just another form of that. But I think there was definitely there were definitely conversations that happened when my grades started declining and when I stopped attending classes, where it was like, okay, what are we going to do here? And so when I talk to my parents about that phase in my life, they say that the reason they didn't end up stepping in and like drawing a line is because then you run the risk of demolishing trust between parent and child. And that's not necessarily beneficial for the child, especially once they leave the nest, whether that is to go work a job or to go to college. Then you actually just have no control. And so if you don't have a trusting relationship with your child, you really haven't done them any good.
So you were self-motivated then to make that change?
Yes.
What was the actual impetus for the change?
I started looking at what people outside of my own world were saying about the online gaming space and Young Men Online. I started just engaging with that to learn more about what I was seeing and why. I think most of what broke my addiction was feeling myself becoming less happy and feeling myself becoming less fulfilled. And then I thrust myself back into the real world. I had to go learn how to make friends and cultivate connections once again. And I didn't really get into the sort of tech reform movement until I was a senior in high school. After watching a documentary called The Social Dilemma, I went to the website of the creators and they had linked to, hey, if you're a young person and you want to plug into making things better, and I say making things better, I guess the issue diagnosis would be what I was talking about earlier, where if you think about every time we use social media to do anything, to communicate with each other, we are communicating in through a medium that does not have our best interests in mind. It has the bottom line of a company in mind. And the way that company makes money is via an addictive business model. And there's all sorts of second order effects. I could go on and on about this stuff, right? This is my area of passion. But on a personal level, like I just said, yeah, I think it would be better because my own personal experience was that I felt better after I stopped spending so much time online. I thought it would be better if other people did too. And so I went to log off. I emailed the woman who created the group back in 2020. And I said, I asked her, like, would you be willing to have me on in some sort of position to assist with the cause? We connected pretty quickly. She had a similar experience, but it was an experience that you often hear young women talk about where they have body image issues that are either exacerbated or entirely emergent from spending a lot of time on short-form video apps that have figured out that the best way to get user number 200 who happens to be a woman and 14, like the best way to get her on the platform is by feeding her content that makes her insecure about her body. Yeah, it's just pretty awful stuff. And I just started in the same way that I was talking about climate earlier. I started just wrestling with what does it mean for our political campaigns? What does it mean for our children's programming? What does it mean for journalism? If like all of the way we're communicating is happening through these platforms that exist to serve a goal that is not aligned with our goals.
So the irony here is that you're doing podcasts, you're doing communication of all kinds, and of course it's on the internet. So do you find yourself engaging more one-on-one, joining communities in person on campus? And have you found people of common interest with you there? Is it a good community?
Yeah, I have friends and I have people that I work with. On this specific issue, the sort of log off and log off adjacent stuff, most of the work that's happening is happening. It's pretty federated. Like, because the harms are not centralized, the harms of social media are not centralized in any one location, that means people who are experiencing the harms and deciding they want to change things are also not going to be centralized in one location. Most of the people I work with in my volunteer advocacy work, I do not live with at McAllister. But there are plenty of people at McAllister who are of the same spirit of innovating change and making the world a better place.
With that uplifting thought, we'll leave our guests, Zoe Gerwitz, Matthew Lair, and Sydney Janda, and thank them for educating us about their experiences and perceptions, and for allowing us to get some insight into their lived experience in this period of their lives and in the life of our country.
Our thanks from me, Julie B. Adler, to Berkshire Alley, WTBR-FM 89.7 Pittsfield, and the Berkshire Eagle for their support.
We hope that you enjoyed this episode and found food for thought and further discussion with family, friends, and the wider community. If you want to repeat this episode and hear the others in our series on resilience, as well as our episodes on food, housing, climate, and health, you can find them at Living Well into the Future on WTBRFM.com, Apple Podcasts, and other streaming services. Subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. We invite you to contribute to Living Well into the Future with your suggestions for topics, comments, and even guests. Write to us at LWITF22@gmail.com or through our website at livingwellintothefuture.com, where you can find show notes, past episodes, and information about our guests.
This podcast is produced by Julie Copenheffer. Our music is written and performed by Michael Copenheffer. The opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and not of WTBR-FM, Berkshire Ollie, or the Berkshire Eagle, or the LWITF production team.